Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Public lands of the western United States comprise roughly 450 million acres of grassland, steppe, desert, and forest managed in trust for the American people by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service. Today's guest, investigative journalist Christopher Ketchum, says the agencies in charge of safeguarding public lands are not doing their jobs. In his new book, This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption are Ruining the American West, he writes, quote, "The government agencies entrusted to oversee our public lands are failing us. The private interests that want the land for profit have planted their teeth in the government. The national trend is against the preservation of the commons. Huge stretches are effectively privatized, public in name only. I went west to see what we were losing as a people. It is still possible in this country to find wild, clean, open spaces where the rhythms of the natural world go on as they should, relatively undisturbed by industrial man. I fear that opportunity, though, could disappear in our lifetime," end quote. So how much public land still remains untouched by regulators and corporations, and what will it take to save these lands? Christopher Ketchum is an investigative reporter whose work has appeared in many publications, including Harper's and National Geographic, and he joins us via Skype from the Catskill Mountains of New York. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Well, thank you for joining us, and congratulations on this very important book. You spent more than 10 years traveling, interviewing, and doing field research, and a number of the reviewers said that your book is for people who care about the earth. Talk about what started this journey.
Well, just living on the public land, car camping, backpacking, spending time in the ecosystems. So in the sagebrush steppe, or in the canyonlands, the mountains, the forests, in the riparian zones, on the rivers, and seeing so much of our public land created by rampant unregulated industry. In particular, one of the uses that really set me off in writing this book was the sight of denuded landscapes resulting from overgrazing of cattle. And not only denuded landscapes, but landscapes that were covered in feces and filth, in which the normally clear-running springs are turned to mud, undrinkable with contaminants such as E. coli.
Christopher, we have a bad line, so I'm going to read a little bit from your book, and we'll call you back to try to get a better connection.
Okay.
We're talking with Christopher Ketchum about his book, This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West. Sorry about that bad line. We tried to get him on Skype, but that wasn't a good connection either. So I just want to read a little bit from his book. He writes that he's been wandering the public lands trying to figure out what's left of the wild in the West, Utah, Nevada, Idaho, Oregon, Wyoming, the states with the most public land. He says it's a giant experiment in socialism out West. Who could have imagined it in the most capitalistic country on earth, where everyone can say they own hundreds of millions of acres, but no single person can claim it for themselves alone? He writes, in the countryside of the East, the public lands are few. Whole mountains are privatized. Rivers and their banks, seashores, meadows, forests get hung with no trespassing and do not enter signs and keep out. Always there are fences, always the threat of prosecution for taking a walk in the woods. Forget about moving across the landscape freely, spontaneously, voluntarily. Whereas in the West, in the lands that were never privatized, that is not the case. And we have Christopher back. Let's see if this is a better line.
Yeah, well, can you hear me?
Yes.
I live way out in the countryside of the Catskill Mountains, so who knows? It's probably the coyotes tampering with the line.
Yeah, that's actually a much better story. We can visualize the coyotes out there. It sounds much better. So talk a little bit more. You were just talking about all the travels that you've done, and we're going to spend a lot of time talking about cattle, but I think that's where we left off.
Yeah, so just seeing the destruction of, or not the destruction, but the degradation of the landscape as a result of overgrazing of cattle. You know, it's pretty disheartening when you see entire meadows up in the uplands of mountain ranges that have been grazed clean of grasses and wildflowers, or you see riparian areas, that is, the areas where you've got intermittent flow of streams, where, you know, the stream itself, instead of being clear and beautiful, is fouled with feces, undrinkable because of contaminants such as E. coli. When you see vast stretches of the sage steppe that have been devastated as a result of so-called pest control, invasive species control by the federal government on behalf of livestock ranchers, you know, when you see and hear of predator control programs such as that operated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in the form of a branch of the USDA known as Wildlife Services, when you see this, our federal regulators and federal tax dollars going towards the mass destruction of coyote populations, speaking of coyotes, or beavers, or prairie dogs, or mountain lions. You know, I mean, as a amateur naturalist, but also as a citizen, I recoil at these things. And so that was one of the reasons that I started writing the book, because of the destruction that I saw on the landscape from livestock grazing.
We'll talk about livestock grazing in just a minute, but I just want to mention that in the beginning of the book, you've got a map of the U.S. that shows states with the most public lands: Utah, Nevada, Idaho, Oregon, Wyoming. And you write that this is a gigantic experiment in socialism. Who could have imagined it in the most capitalistic country on earth, where everyone can say they own hundreds of millions of acres, but no single person can claim it for themselves? Can you talk more about that?
Well, yeah, it is truly an anomaly in the history of this hyper-capitalistic nation that we should have so much land set aside as a commons owned by every American citizen, including, by the way, every newly naturalized immigrant. I mean, it is all our land. And I would think is socialism in its purest form, which is the shared ownership of land, in which no one person is supposed to be privileged above the other. Unfortunately, it hasn't worked out that way. And this is another reason I wrote the book, because as I first got to know the public lands and got to understand the regulatory system by which they're managed, I discovered, as have many before me, that that federal land managers and their agencies have been captured and corrupted by the very industries that they're supposed to be regulating. So in the case of the Bureau of Land Management, they are the BLM is a creature of the livestock industry, but also the mineral extraction interests. So oil and gas, hard rock mining, the Forest Service. You know, we think of the Forest Service as the protectors of the trees. No, in fact, they are the liquidators of the trees, and they always have been. Forest Service is a creature of the timber industry, logging interests. So seeing this. Horrendous fact that the agencies tasked with managing the land on our behalf, the shared commons, are not doing what they're supposed to be doing, well, that's another thing at which to recoil and which I felt needed to be exposed.
You know, we talk more these days, I think, because Trump is in office, about the Department of the Interior. But we definitely don't talk very much about BLM, the United States Bureau of Land Management, or the United States Forest Service. So you've got a lot of stories in your book about how these government agencies have been compromised. If you had to pick a couple, which ones would you share? What do you think people need to know more about?
About agency compromise?
Yeah, about BLM specifically in the U.S. Forest Service, since they don't get talked about that much in the media.
Right. Well, the BLM, remember, is a branch of the Department of the Interior, whereas the Forest Service is a branch of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And just very quickly, the reason for that is that the Forest Service was established specifically as a as an agency for the felling of timber. And, of course, that comes under the branch, under the auspices of the USDA. So, yes, why do we not hear more about the BLM and the Forest Service? The funny thing is they oversee incredible acreage, you know, hundreds of millions of acres, far more acreage than the National Park Service. And these are, in some cases, truly wild landscapes, like places where you can really get lost, where there are sizable populations of wildlife remaining in sometimes very healthy habitat. But, you know, they're not, a lot of these landscapes are not, they're not postcard vistas. They're not the fast food vistas that motorized recreationists want from their public lands. You know, some of them, like, for example, the sagebrush steppe, or what ecologists call the sagebrush sea, is almost entirely managed by the BLM. And these are vast stretches of undulating landscape, what are called the intermountain plains, where the distances, you know, defy understanding, where you have an incredibly complex biotic system of sagebrush and animals like the sage grouse and the pronghorn antelope all interacting. But from just a visual standpoint, there's not much to see. It's just this rolling, this vast rolling landscape. So people generally want to have a waterfall and a granitic peak towering in the distance, and maybe some snowfall on a hillside, and they want to see green forests and that kind of thing. So I think that is part of it. The failure of imagination on the part of visitors in seeing these really complex landscapes that from a visual standpoint are not as thrilling as, you know, Rocky Mountain National Park,
right,
for example.
Right, where people bring their selfie sticks, although I think they may have banned those by now, which is a good thing.
The only advantage of selfie sticks is it allows people to stand next to very high cliffs and waterfalls and fall off.
Which, unfortunately, unfortunately that has happened. But I think they're in the process of being banned. You know, when in your first section, you wrote about the bull hog, and this visual is really disturbing. You write, "Here's what's happening to our land. It is May 2018 in the Egan Range of Nevada, south of Ely, and a machine called a bull hog is approaching." Can you tell us about what it was? What is a bull hog, and what was it like to see a bulldozer like this?
Right. Well, a bull hog is just a D9 caterpillar, large-sized bulldozer, with a spinning cylinder affixed to its front that's bladed, and then as it travels through a landscape, it shreds everything in its path. So in this case, I was tracking it with an ecologist named Katie Fite of a group called Wildlands Defense, and we were just wandering the Egan Range looking for examples of deforestation projects run by the BLM. And we saw a bunch of dust in the distance and hiked up through the mountains and found this this bull hog charging through a pinyon juniper forest. So this is pygmy forest. You know, these are trees that are maybe 20 feet high. And the bull hog would plow into these trees and then shred them. So it was instant mastication. And what remained was just a devastated landscape.
Hmm.
Dust and the entrails of trees where nothing will grow. What was the purpose of this bull hog's activities? Well, to create more forage for cows. So what they're going to do is they destroy the pinyon juniper, and then the BLM, that is, destroys pinyon juniper, and then plans to replace it with grass for cattle grazing.
So let's dive in and talk about cattle grazing. It's so interesting when we talk about cows, because cows are getting a lot more attention because of the climate crisis. But I think the history of cattle in this country is just so important, and you really go into that, and you do a great job of it in your book. In Chapter 5, you write, "The simple version of how the public lands livestock industry got its start begins with the near extermination of bison on the Great Plains in the last decades of the 19th century. It begins, that is, in the throes of ecocide. The complex version involves the advent of the transcontinental railroad and the technology of refrigeration, the growing market for beef," and you go on that one, and then you say, "I prefer the simple version. Without the destruction of the buffalo, a cattle culture in the West might never have developed."
Yes.
Can you talk more about that?
Sure. With westward expansion, the main impediment on the high plains were the ferocious plains warriors, the Sioux, the Lakota, and many others, who depended for their lives, for their livelihood, for their very survival on the vast herds of buffalo that once roamed the plains. And so a strategic decision was made on the part of the U.S. government to facilitate the extermination of buffalo in order to subjugate the restive Native American tribes. And into this mix came the open range cattle industry, which got its start in Texas and in the 1840s and 50s. And 60s, and with the Civil War, the cattle industry had been embargoed, because of course Texas is part of the Confederacy. But after the Civil War, the Texan cattlemen saw an opportunity to expand the open range system all across the West, as they watched the buffalo being exterminated through both market hunting and in general facilitation by the U.S. military. And so there you have it. In brief, the U.S. Army and railroads and cattlemen all got together to destroy buffalo. And net result, the manifest destiny could be fulfilled. The white man could take over the West, and among those white men, most notably, were cattle ranchers who now filled the ecological niche of buffalo with their vast herds of grazing cattle. And so that ecocide, and it's astonishing to consider what happened in that 30-year, 40-year time span in which you had tens of millions of bison just wiped out.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say next, is you write that as measured in biomass, bison may have comprised the largest ever concentration of an animal species in the modern history of the planet. They were said to have numbered as many as 75 million when English colonists settled the shores of Virginia in the 1600s. By the time the Euro-Americans crossed the Great Plains in the 1840s, that population was decimated, the result of 2 centuries of hide hunting by mountain men in the West and the encroachment of settlers in the East. So about, as you write, about 20 million buffalo remained?
Yeah, and they were just wiped out. I mean, they were so beleaguered that by 1900, there's an estimated maybe 20, 24, between 19 and 24 wild buffalo.
Wow.
Still in existence. I mean, that's an incredible achievement. Just the scale of destruction, the rapacity, the level of violence, the level of waste and stupidity on an epic scale. Very American, very American.
Very American. And as you write, the buffalo fed, fueled, clothed the Plains Indians. It was a sacred animal, a holy spirit. It was the linchpin of their physical and spiritual survival. And this relationship needed to end if the white man was to take the plains.
Indeed.
Today we're speaking with Christopher Ketchum about his new book, This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West. And if you have any questions or comments about public lands in the West, about the BLM, the Forest Service, and he's just got such important information about cattle and how it came to be and how it is destroying the land today, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a couple minutes before break, but I think this is really important to still go over. You mentioned this, but you write, the railroads, the federal government, and the cattlemen saw eye to eye. The government made it official policy to slaughter buffalo. It hired hunters to aid the effort. Eastern cities and the markets of Europe sold on the romance of the buffalo robe, hastened by the buffalo's demise. So you had buffalo coats selling in salons in New York and Paris. And so that, I mean, it's just the numbers are astonishing, just how much the buffalo hide shot up over the course of just a couple years.
Right. Well, what I think the most fascinating part of that whole history is that this is one of the first examples of unregulated globalism, where you had investors, mostly from England and Scotland, seeing an opportunity in a laxly regulated part of the world, in fact, a totally unregulated part of the world, where they could make an easy profit. Facilitated, as I mentioned, by government intervention on behalf of all those private market interests. So it was the U.S. military that really, it was the U.S. military with the Army of the West, coupled with U.S. Funding and subsidization of railroads, that then allowed for the massive market hunting that eventually really destroyed buffalo. And again, the hides and the robes were for a time considered luxury items, fetching very high prices, and the expectable result, without any regulation, was the destruction of the quote unquote resource, to reduce buffalo to a resource. Of course, is hideous, but you know, that's how people thought of these animals, and that's how a lot of people today still think of animals, which is another part of my book.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and in the book, General Nelson Miles, a commander of a garrison in Montana in 1876, is quoted as saying, "When we get rid of the Indians and buffalo, the cattle will fill this country." And we'll talk more about cattle after a break. Today, we're speaking with investigative journalist Christopher Ketchum about his new book, This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak about the upcoming 9th Annual Legacy Film Festival on Aging. We are also hoping to get someone from the Bahamas to give us an update about what is happening there. Wednesday, we'll be speaking with Françoise Girard, president of the International Women's Health Coalition. We will talk about the state of reproductive rights around the globe. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And as you know, every Monday on our One Planet series, we talk about a number of issues affecting the planet. And you can also find those shows at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Christopher Ketchum, author of This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West. Christopher has written for many publications, including Harper's and National Geographic. So let's talk about cattle. And if you can share some of the history about how so many cattle have come to the United States. I mean, how did it happen so fast? As you write, cattle have been implicated in the eradication of native plants, the pollution of springs and streams, the denuding of cover for birds and mammals. Conservation biologists have concluded that grazing is the, quote, most insidious and pervasive threat to biodiversity on rangelands. So talk about the history of cattle first. We talked about the bison, but then after the bison were murdered, and what happened? How did these ranchers bring so many cattle to the West so quickly?
I don't really go too deeply into the history of cattle ranching per se in the book. My interest is more in, okay, you have this you have a takeover of the landscape by the cattle industry, and how do the numbers proliferate? Well, cattle proliferate. It's very simple, given enough food, enough space. So what was fascinating to me in the history here, right, is the ecological devastation that occurred as a result of this invasive species, this European species, Bos taurus, being brought into an arid landscape. And so you have accounts, for example, in areas like southern Utah of grass so thick and high that sheep would disappear in it, that it would tickle the bellies of horses. And you look at these areas today, and there is no grass tickling the bellies of horses. That's all gone. And it was wiped out in a very short period of time when Mormon cattlemen settled in southern Utah in the 1870s, and within 20 years had so denuded the landscape that nothing of that old, of that previous biotic richness and complexity remained. There was a biotic simplification. The landscape became depauperate, and you see this all across the West. And that happened again in a very short period of time. You have basically cattle invading the West in the 1860s and 70s. By the 1920s, by the 1910s, you have a totally transformed landscape, a transformation that has been compared to a geologic event in terms of how it alters landforms, how it alters the very surface of the earth. And why is this so? Well, again, these are landscapes that did not evolve with the type of grazer that a cow is. And there are some, you know, apologists for the cattle industry who would say that bison and cattle operate in the same act in the same way on a landscape. This is a lie. It's not true, but it's promulgated by again, apologists for the industry. And then you have large areas of the West that never had any bison, that never adapted to large herds of ungulates, of bovids like cattle or like bison. And so these lands that had not evolutionarily adapted to the presence of large grazers, well, they were quickly devastated and irrevocably altered by the and there's no better word for it, the invasion of these of cattle. So, you know, it's just incredible when you think of the extent of cattle grazing on the public lands, and then the extent of the destruction of plants. I mean, it's plants, it's destruction of pollution of water, it's the trampling of fragile soils, coupled with a program of extreme aggressive intervention on the part of the federal government to continually protect the cattle industry from predators and alleged pests, along with things like stream diversions and dewatering of water courses, and the list goes on and on and on, to the point that there is one estimate that something like $1 billion a year is spent on subsidies for public lands ranchers, both in terms of state and federal monies. And this for the production, by the way, of something like 2% of all beef in this nation. That is, all the millions of cattle that go out on public lands get only 2% of their forage from those lands. Which is to say that in terms of the available grass, there's not much to eat on those public lands. And that's because they're fragile, and they were not meant for cows. So, but again, listeners should just take that to mark that statistic. 2% of beef, and for that 2%, we, the taxpayers, are ponying up $1 billion a year.
So given what we know about the cattle industry and what you have reported, grazing is today the most widespread single use of the public domain, occurring on 270 million acres of national forest and BLM land. You write, some ecologists believe grazing is the primary cause of species extinction, topsoil loss, and desertification in the West. And then this is a planetary problem. About 8.4 billion acres on the planet are grazed. So given that, you have criticism of some of the big environmental groups, which we'll talk about more later. Why don't you think more environmental groups talk about this issue? As I said, you know, beef and meat, it's getting a lot more attention because of the climate crisis. But the issues that you go into in this book deserve far more attention. Why don't the environmental groups spend more time on this?
Well, first off, to your point about desertification, yeah, desertification in the age of climate change is a pivotal issue, and we should be addressing every factor that leads to desertification. So if cattle, as almost all the science now shows us, if cattle grazing is producing widespread desertification in the arid West, yeah, we should do something to address it and stop it. Now, why aren't green groups doing so? Yeah, it's complex. It's like I think part of it has to do with the cowboy mythos that that America has been laboring under ever since the first cattleman went west. This idea of the self-reliant, individualistic, hardy, free man on the range. It's always a man, you know. Something attractive about that. There's a romance of the range, and I think that there are conservationists out there who see the cowboy and say, "Hey, here's a chance. Here's a chance to work with someone who's a salt of the earth, of the land, who we might ally with to battle back, say, the oil and gas industry, or hard rock." hard rock mineral industry, or abusers of off-road vehicles. So I think there's that. It's also, you know, if you're a conservationist on the ground in the West, on the public lands of the West, you're going to deal with cattlemen quite a lot, and they're a aggressive bunch of folks. And from my experience, conservationists are a meek and wilting bunch of folks, and don't have the kind of necessary courage and stamina to stand up to the very aggressive cowboy culture. So I think that, I mean, I don't know if that goes a little way towards answering your question. But beyond that, I'm not sure why conservation groups don't play up the cattle issue. And maybe also, you know, there's a in Congress, in the Western Caucus in Congress, hugely favors the cattle industry, again, for reasons that have nothing to do with economics or a cost-benefit calculus, but everything to do with the mythos, the romance, the idea of the cattleman, rather than the reality being this is an industry heavily subsidized and highly destructive to native ecosystems.
Today we're speaking with investigative journalist Christopher Ketchum about his new book, This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West. In his book, Christopher writes, if I were to have my way on the public lands, if I could do anything I wanted in a program of action to save them from destruction, top of the list would be cow exorcism. Send the cattle to Florida, Virginia, Maryland, good places for the bovines with lots of rain and plentiful grass. Let them graze the Washington Mall and the White House lawn, anywhere but our Western commons. We rid the West of cows and we would have an ecological recovery, the likes of which has never occurred in modern history. And if you have a question or a comment for Christopher, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We've got a couple emails, Christopher. Alan writes, it's ironic that the hog-like dozer machine rips apart a juniper forest to create grazing land. The West has a large percentage of land that has been forage or grassland for a long time. Isn't it make work to be creating this? He writes, my question is about the grasslands. The Forest Service, U.S. Department of Agriculture, has grasslands under its domain, but are they doing anything other than making grassland more accessible to farms and big access?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I did not spend a lot of time looking at USDA and Forest Service. It's the USDA, yeah, USDA grassland policy. So I don't know.
All right. Thank you for that, Alan. We have another question from Eric. He says, thank you so much for featuring these issues. As someone whose family has camped across the country for 11 years, spending as much time as possible on public land, I feel very engaged in issues surrounding these places. Can you talk about the American Prairie Reserve in Montana? This is a nonprofit that's attempting to recreate large connected tracts of land in order to bring back the migrating herds of wild beasts that are so symbolically important to renew the American West.
Yeah, it's a buffalo preserve. Yeah, I mean, I heartily support the American Prairie Reserve. I, you know of it only tangentially, especially, you know, I focused on the public lands. A lot of that is private land. And you know, it's a lovely endeavor. However, in the long term, private land is mutable, and who knows what can happen to it? It could be sold, change of ownership, funders pull out. You know, who knows? Who knows? That is in terms of the durable future of such a project. But I think it's great. I think it's beautiful. I think we need more efforts like that.
He also has another question. Can you talk about specific things the Trump administration is doing under the cover of Trump's noise floor of unimportant daily tweets that involve the lands we all own?
It's just more of the same. I mean, I very painstakingly in the book I elucidate how previous administrations and the Trump administration present a continuum of destruction on the public lands. So people, you know, their progressives like to say, well, Obama was great for the public lands. It's simply not true. He was not a great president for the public lands. Why? Because our presidents, in general, do not represent ecological interests. They represent a system called capitalism, and that system marches on regardless of who's in office. And the system of capitalism on the public lands means more subjugation and domination of wild landscapes for profit and pillage. So, yeah, Trump is bad. Trump is terrible. So were previous administrations. And the issue here is not Trump. The issue is the God-forsaken system that is driving us toward climate crisis, climate apocalypse, that is driving the extinction crisis, that is that reduces the natural world to a sink for our filth and a source for our aggrandizement and growth. The problem is this idea of economic growth, of limitless economic growth on a finite planet, which is delusional. Indeed, it's mad. That's the issue. And those are the issues I think people should really be thinking about. Trump is merely a symptom of the larger cancer of capitalism.
2 years into this administration, you went on the road, and in Wyoming's Sublette County, in the mountain girt basin of the Upper Green Raleigh River Valley, where the gas companies invaded in the 90s, armed with hydraulic fracturing, you met a nurse practitioner named Leslie Hagenstein. And so can you tell us about this? You write that you sat in her living room on a September evening, the house she was raised in, looking out the window at a gas well a half a mile away that was drilled in 2016 in the final months of the Obama administration. How has she and her community been affected by fracking?
Well, yeah, so fracking comes into the Upper Green River Valley, a place that was once one of the cleanest, a place that once had some of the cleanest air in the United States. And, well, what results? It is now a place of air that regularly exceeds the EPA standards for healthy air. A place filled with ozone and smog and nitrous oxides and volatile organic compounds. And that's from all the diesel truck activity and the poisons released from the wells themselves. So now Hagenstein, a nurse practitioner, told me she was regularly seeing little children in respiratory distress, little kids. Meanwhile, the county, Sublette County, was flush with money, so they got a new library, they got a new health clinic, a new school, new roads, new this, new that. And so what do people in that county say? They say, well, our air is being poisoned, our water looks like it's being poisoned, our children are sick, but we got a lot more money. And that's sort of how things work. We got a lot more money, but we're all getting sick.
And in this particular area, by the end of the first decade of the 21st century, air pollution there rivaled the worst days in Los Angeles. And you write that about one in three kids in her county require asthma inhalers when they go out to exercise, but on many days they don't go out at all because of ozone alerts.
Yep.
Well, this is one of many stories that we read about in Christopher Ketchum's really important book, This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption are ruining the American West. When you traveled, Christopher, how many fracking sites do you think you saw? mean, how...
Hundreds?
Wow. I mean, for those of us who don't go on road trips, you know, or don't really... A lot of people fly these days, right? So they don't see these things. So you saw hundreds?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And they're hideous. They're absolutely... They're just an abomination on the landscape. I went out in the Pinedale complex. So Leslie Hagenstein lives in Pinedale, Wyoming. Pinedale is the county seat of Sublette County. And then south of Pinedale is what's known as the Pinedale Complex, which is a gigantic gas field. And so I traveled out there with a guy named John Dahlke, who is a bird biologist and ecologist, and used to hunt in that area sage grouse. Now, sage grouse in 2015 became an incredibly controversial species in that there was a effort by conservation groups to force the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list sage grouse as an endangered species. And if such a listing were to come to pass, it would have shut down hundreds of millions of acres of the West. That's all sage grouse habitat, right? Hundreds of millions of acres of the West to oil and gas drilling and livestock grazing. So, guess what happened? The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, serving its real masters in industry, decided, nah, sage grouse don't need the protections of the Endangered Species Act. We're gonna come up with a plan with the help of the livestock industry and the oil and gas industry to try to save little portions of their habitat. And so sage grouse continued to decline. Now, in the Pinedale complex, they disappeared altogether because of oil and gas, or because of gas drilling, because of fracking. So I went out on the landscape with John Dahlke, and he was describing to me how just 15 years ago there was nothing here. 20 years ago, it was wild, beautiful landscape, full of birds. And now it's full of compressor stations and pipelines and drill pads and roads and more roads and industrial-scale traffic and noise. But there's a lot of money to be made, so to heck with the sage grouse.
Well, let's take a couple callers. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Well, this is pretty bleak, I have to say. And I don't think capitalism is going to fall anytime soon in this country. So it makes me wonder what it will take for a sense of urgency to compel people in large numbers to engage in whatever kind of action is needed to see if they can change this situation. And then with regard to the cattle issue, I don't know, because I'm at a loss for suggestions about how to address this, but I'm wondering, consumers, I don't think the states could ban, you know, the importation of, you know, beef products from these states that you're talking about. But people do buy, you know, they shop and they buy these things and other things, and I'm wondering if there's any way that, you know, that might be an option. I mean, if you could get a consumer boycott going, you know, and pressure, I just don't know. I'm just thinking, you know, what might help? And I don't know if that's a possibility, but it seems to me that economics does speak to these people. It may have been a factor in Walmart's change on their gun policy. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
All right. Thanks, Greg. What do you think, Christopher?
Consumer boycott of public lands beef would achieve almost nothing, given that public lands beef is such a minimal part of the marketplace. So there's that. And there's also the fact that how do you tell? I mean, it's very difficult to, once beef, you know, beef gets, the open range cattle will go and feed on public lands and then go to a feedlot and get finished, quote unquote, finished there before they get before they get chopped up for consumers at the supermarket. So how do you tell which beef is public lands and which isn't? No, that's not going to work. What's needed is citizen outrage, citizen engagement, calling your congressperson, calling your state elected officials, calling the BLM managers and Forest Service managers, and demanding something be done, and maintain a continual a vice grip of pressure on these people to change this policy. That's the way to change things. It's through the actions of a great mass of people in a concerted, unified effort.
What do you think? We have just about a minute left. The global climate strike is happening September 20th through the 27th. Mm-hmm. We're taking part in an effort. It's about 200 different media organizations doing a week-long series on the climate crisis. You know, Standing Rock did so much, indigenous activism. The climate marches are happening all the time. I mean, what do you think about just these social movements and the change?
I think they're wonderful.
Yeah.
I think we need more of them. I think we need more civil disobedience. I think we need more disruption. I think we need more people like Extinction Rebellion going out and shutting things down, causing trouble, spreading mayhem and havoc, so that we can no longer see business as usual as business as usual. We have to stop the machine.
And we'd love to have you back, Christopher, but what would you say, what places are the least assaulted at this point?
Oh, the least assaulted. There are areas of the Sage Steppe that are especially free of human influence, because they're just so far flung, so distant. Portions of the canyons of Utah, those areas not over visited by recreationists, because that's another problem. That's actually an article I'm working on now about the recreation industry, recreation capitalism, and how destructive that can be for wildlife and wildlands. There are stretches of the national forest in Idaho that are just beautiful. Just beautiful, but we have to stand up against the logging industry that wants them no longer to be beautiful. I'd say the national parks, but a lot of the national parks are just a madhouse of visitation and automobile traffic and too many people. I don't know. Let me come up with a list, and I'll get back to you.
All right. Well, we'd love to have you back. Thank you so much for writing this important book, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. That's Christopher Ketchum. He is the author of This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West. And you can find more about his work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.